informational meeting, which we will hold to the end. And at this point, we have three bills before us that we will conduct public hearings on. So at this point, I will open the public hearing on SB 26. Council?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 26 allows the Attorney General to represent the state of Oregon as a lead plaintiff in certain securities fraud cases. This is an amendment to ORS 180.060 sub 3. That statute provides very limited exceptions, actually currently only one exception, for the Attorney General to be able to provide legal advice or representation to someone who is not a state agency or actor. This would add an additional exception to permit the Attorney General to be lead plaintiff for the state, in any class action involving a security matter, even though the other members of the class are not state actors.
Thank you. And we have a couple people signed up. Kate Richardson from the Treasurer's Office and a representative from the Attorney General's Office. So you can figure out how to start. Please proceed. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff for the State Treasurer, and I'm here on behalf of the speak in favor of Senate Bill 26 that the Treasurer has put in this session. This bill is a narrow change to ORS Chapter 180. A question has arisen whether Chapter 180, which provides the Attorney General shall not give legal advice to persons other than state officers, prevents the Attorney General from representing state officers and agencies as lead plaintiffs in class actions. This interpretation has prevented the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, which is necessarily represented by the Attorney General, from serving as a lead plaintiff in class action securities fraud cases. This bill would clarify the statute and resolve this issue. As you may be aware, the fund regularly participates in federal securities class action suits when it suffered losses due to fraud or other security violations. For those class actions, the court appoints a lead plaintiff to represent the members of the class. To date, Oregon's been unable to seek to be the lead plaintiff in any of the class actions in which it has been a member of the class. Pension funds from numerous other states, including California, New York, Wisconsin, Utah, Minnesota, and Florida, have served as lead plaintiffs in security fraud class actions. The Treasurer believes Oregon should have the ability to join these states in taking the lead to enforce the securities laws and keep our national securities markets free from fraud. Oregon's fund is one of the largest public institutional investors in the nation, and in some cases may be the best suited to perform the role of lead plaintiff to maximize recovery for a class. If Oregon can serve as a potential lead class plaintiff, it will join other states in leading the effort to recover pension funds, school funds, and other state funds that have been lost to fraud. This will benefit the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, as well as Oregon consumers, retirees, and taxpayers, among others. The state could be in a better position to negotiate and monitor attorney fees to oversee settlement discussions and case strategy, and negotiate other remedies that would benefit the market, such as corporate governance changes. Although Oregon currently has the ability to opt out of these class actions and seek separate recourse, Oregon should have the flexibility to act as a lead plaintiff in a particular case if the circumstance warrant and the court appoints, and join with other states that are prominent leaders in enforcing the securities laws. And Madam Chair, Fred Boss from the Department of Justice has the Attorney General's point of view.
Thank you. Do any committee members have questions of Ms. Richardson before we move on? Thank you. Proceed.
My name is Frederick M. Boss, and I am an Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. Chair Burdick, committee members, I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 26. The Department of Justice is of the opinion that it cannot represent a state fund as a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit. My written testimony, which I've provided to you, details our analysis chapter by chapter. But basically, there's a conflict between the Attorney General's duty of loyalty solely to the state of Oregon and that of a class counsel, which has a duty to not only to the class, the named class plaintiff, but also to all the putative class members. This Senate Bill 26 provides for a narrow change to Chapter 180, which would allow the Department of Justice to represent a state fund as a class action plaintiff in a securities class action lawsuit. Securities class action lawsuits are often the primary vehicle for recovering funds in for securities fraud. It's a very convenient vehicle in which a large gathering of affected parties can group together and use their resources against usually a very powerful corporation. We do not anticipate that this tool would be used frequently, but it would be useful to ensure an adequate recovery in those cases in which we would want to use it. Reasons why we would want to be a represent, or why a state fund would want to be a lead plaintiff would be to ensure that there is an adequate recovery to all the class members, also to negotiate what the attorney fees would be to make sure that the class counsel would not take a disproportionate portion of the recovery as their percentage of the recovery. And then also, if you're essentially in the driver's seat, you can have other factors to be included in a potential settlement, such as corporate governance factors that an audit team, if there's a corporation that has an ongoing, that will be an ongoing concern, unlike some that would potentially go into bankruptcy, you could ensure that they have a proper, adequate audit team, that the directors are truly watching what the officers are doing, that there's responsibility, various other factors that a fund such as PERF would want as part of its participation in the marketplace. So I urge you to support Senate Bill 26 or to pass it out, and I would be pleased to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. At this point, I would like to, because we are down to such a minimal number in this committee, it would be my wish to move this bill out unless people have concerns about it. So I'd like to find out those concerns if they exist, or whether there's a preference to wait by the committee members. So are there any concerns?
Madam Chair, from my perspective, I think it makes complete sense to allow Oregon to try to recover funds in this manner. So I certainly think it makes sense.
Thank you very much. At this point, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 26 and open a work session on Senate Bill 26. Senator Ringo, would you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 26 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Ringo, if you would carry this. Thank you. At this time, we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 203. Counsel?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 203 has to do with the statute of limitations for several enumerated felonies and misdemeanors that have to do with sex abuse, child sex abuse, and child abuse. The current statute is for felonies is a 6-year statute of limitation. The current statute for the enumerated misdemeanors is a 4-year statute of limitations. But there are alternatives that are built within the statute. For example, it can be 6 years from the date of the commission. It can be 6 years from the time that the person reaches the age of 24 if the act was committed before the person was 18, excuse me. And then the third alternative is that the prosecution can be commenced within 6 years if it's a felony, 4 years if it's a misdemeanor, quote, after the offense is reported to a law enforcement agency or other governmental agency. This bill would change that third alternative, deleting the language language "other governmental agency" and replacing it with the Department of Human Services. The change is designed to make sure that another non-enforcement government agency, such as a public school teacher, a report to that sort of person does not trigger the statute and therefore preclude later prosecution.
Thank you very much. We will start with Jonathan Fussner from the Department of Justice. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. Mr. O'Leary has just given you a pretty good introduction to the way the statute of limitations works. It's normally 6 years for a felony sex crime, but because child sex crime victims often do not report immediately after the crime, there is a provision in ORS 131.125, subsection 2, that's the statute of limitations, that allows the prosecution to be commenced within 6 years after the child reports the crime to law enforcement or another governmental agency. The problem has arisen that this Senate Bill 203 seeks to address because there is no statutory definition of what other governmental agency means. And we had an opinion from the Oregon Court of Appeals that had to determine what that other governmental agency means, and what they concluded was that it means any governmental agency or employee who is a mandatory reporter, that is, who has the duty to report sex crimes against children to law enforcement or the Department of Human Services. And I want to emphasize to you how broadly that sweeps. Under the Walker opinion that's discussed in my written testimony, if a child tells a next-door neighbor who happens to work as a maintenance person at a school district that she's been sexually abused, that begins the running of the statute of limitations, even if the person to whom that report is made takes no action on it. If a child reports to a paramedic, to a dentist, to a chiropractor, to a licensed child care provider, indeed to a member of this legislative assembly, all of those people are mandatory reporters and, at least in theory, should pass that on to law enforcement or Department of Human Services. But as unfortunately happens, sometimes they don't do that. And what we end up with, as in the Walker case, is the statute of limitations has run because, unbeknownst to anyone, the child in Walker had reported the sexual sodomy to a substitute teacher at her school who did nothing about it. The purpose of Senate Bill 203 is to say this: the statute of limitations runs from the time that the child reports the crime to law enforcement or to Department of Human Services, because they are the two agencies that can actually take action and begin their own investigation of the crime. It seems like good policy to begin the running of the statute of limitations when an agency that can take some action on it finds out about it. And let me close by just emphasizing that the bill does not change the length of the statute of limitations at all. All that it does is it clarifies under this one particular part of the statute when it is triggered, when it begins to run.
That's correct. And to clarify your testimony, it's not the burden of the child to report it to the Department of Human Resources. It's the fact that the crime is reported.
That's correct.
Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me exactly what Section 2 of the bill means? It's pretty obvious, the first part about, you know, offenses on, before, or after the effective of the act, but then do not operate to revive a prosecution barred by the operation of whatever 131.125 is. Could you explain that?
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, the reason that that Section 2 is in there is because we have case law that says if you have a statute of limitations, let's say it's 6 years, and the statute of limitations is still in effect. A crime could be prosecuted, say you're 5 years out. And the Legislative Assembly extends the statute so that let's say it's then 8 years. The courts have said that's all right to do, and a prosecution can be brought within 8 years. But if the statute of limitations has run, and you might say that the defendant now has a right not to be prosecuted anymore because the statute has expired, the Legislative Assembly cannot retroactively, at that point, go back and say, oh, well, we'll make it 8 years instead of six and scoop up these additional defendants. And so the intent of this is to say that the amendment here would apply to cases that are still within the statute of limitations as of the effective date of the legislation, but it won't go back and allow crimes to be prosecuted that are now already barred or would be barred on the effective date of the legislation.
Follow up. Thank you. So if I heard you correctly, then you said that was a Supreme Court or appellate court decision that said you cannot go back and reopen those cases if once the it's elapsed, whatever.
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, that's correct. I can't recall off the top of my head whether it's an Oregon Supreme Court or Court of Appeals opinion, but it's pretty settled law that the constitutional ex post facto prohibition operates so that once the statute of limitations has run, it has run forever and can't be revived.
Another question? Uh-huh. Thank you. Under current law, and I don't know how long it's been current law and who the mandatory reporters and you know when they, I know some got added in 97 and some got added later, maybe earlier, but under current law, if we don't make this change, what happens if the perpetrator of a crime is also a mandatory reporter and he doesn't say anything, nobody says anything for 6 years, has then that like maybe a governor?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, I have to admit I had not thought about that possibility. That's a little scary. I don't quite know how to answer that one, but it may be that the defendant can avoid criminal liability by, in effect, reporting it to himself.
Well, I think the point being that the mandatory reporter has a duty to report and chooses not to report, so under current law, the report would never get made and the statute would start running at that point.
And that's my so it would in that case. That's my question, a clarification. The current law would if the perpetrator of the crime was also a mandatory reporter and he didn't report, but would that start the clock?
I really don't have a good answer to that, but I suspect there may be an argument there that could be made that it would begin running because current law does say whenever it's reported to any government agency, which includes any mandatory reporter, even the defendant, the statute begins to run.
Correct. Good analysis, Senator Beyer. I think there would probably have to be a case to see if the abuse itself constitutes a report. So, okay. Are there other questions? You done? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. John Hummel, please, from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm an attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Statute of limitations exist for a very important reason. They exist to protect the innocent. As time goes by, witnesses disappear, memories fade, and evidence spoils. It becomes more difficult for an innocent person to prove their innocence the farther you get away from the alleged crime. Let me give you an example, and I need to start with the premise on this example. I've never committed a theft in Kansas, so that's important. But if I was charged today with committing a theft in Kansas yesterday, it would be darn easy for me to prove my innocence. I was in Bend yesterday. 15 people saw me. I know who they were. My memory is clear. I'd subpoena them to court, and they'd say, Alma wasn't in Kansas. Case dismissed. If I was charged with committing a theft in Kansas a year ago, I could probably prove my innocence. It'd be more difficult. I still have my date book from last year. I'd look in it. Hopefully I had a meeting on the date of the alleged theft. I'd subpoena that person to court. They would hopefully remember a date a year ago, and I could probably prove my innocence. If I was charged with committing a theft in Kansas 15 years ago, I'd have a difficult time coming up with alibi witnesses. I don't know where I was on a particular date 15 years ago. There's no way I have date books. My memory isn't that good. It's not that great today. It's not that good to remember a date 15 years ago. So anytime we expand the statute of limitations, we increase the risk of innocent people being convicted. That's why generally the Oregon criminal defense lawyers are opposed to expanding the statute of limitations. But Senate Bill 203 presents a unique basis for our opposition. Counsel O'Leary has given a very good overview of the, quite frankly, confusing statute on statute of limitations for sex offenses. It often requires two or three readings, even for seasoned practitioners, to figure it out. But generally, for felony or misdemeanor offenses, sex offenses, the statute of limitations is 6 or 4 years, respectfully. But if the offense is alleged to have occurred when the victim was under 18 years of age, the prosecution can be commenced any time after the victim turns 24 years old or 22 years old, depending on if it's a felony or a misdemeanor. And there's good rationale for that rule. The rationale is that minor victims often do not have the maturity to understand how to report an offense, or they might live in a home with their abuser, and there might be pressure placed on them by their abuser to not report the offense. However, the current statute of limitations exception that allows the charge to be brought at 24 or 22 years of age does not apply when the abuse is actually reported to a government agency. And that makes sense, because then that rationale I just talked about, which is based on situations where, you know, the child may not report or someone may not report on behalf of the child, that rationale goes away because a report has been made. However, this bill would change current law. This bill would remove the incentive that current government agencies have to report suspected child abuse to law enforcement. Right now, if someone goes to their county mental health department and says, I think my 15-year-old neighbor is a victim of sexual abuse, that county mental health department knows, or they should know, that they have to timely report that matter to law enforcement because the 6-year or the 4-year statute of limitations is ticking. If this bill passes, the county mental health department can sit on the complaint. They wouldn't do it intentionally. I don't think we're talking about that, but they won't take it seriously enough. They have other pressing matters. They, for whatever reason, the wrong reason, it would be, but for whatever reason, it doesn't ever rise to the priority list, and they don't get cracking on it, and they know it's not going to impede a criminal prosecution no matter what they do, so they don't do something. And then a child who is a victim of sex abuse could be victimized again, or an innocent person who is alleged to have done that sex abuse can be charged well down the road, 15 years down the road, and will have difficulty locating witnesses who can prove they had nothing to do with that alleged offense. So we do have some concerns about this bill, and we'd ask the committee to give them due consideration. I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Mr. Hummel, how do you respond to the prior testimony that essentially indicated if a report is made to any government agency, let's say a report is made to the county dog catcher, the county dog catcher is going to look at that report and say, well, it shouldn't have been sent to me, I'll just throw this away. What should happen in that case?
Well, two responses to that. First, the current bill, we still have that problem because by saying the Department of Human Services, you could have a temporary maintenance worker who's employed by the Department of Human Services, and we could create scenarios where the same absurd result might happen.
But at least it reduces that possibility.
It does, and I would, OCDOA would look favorably on an amendment that would define other governmental agency to be agencies that are trained properly and have administrative oversight over sex abuse allegations, such as mental health departments, such as the Department of Human Services. And I think it should be focused on full-time staff members so we don't get a temporary intern or part-time worker. Those are absurd results. But I think limiting it just to the Department of Human Services, while not having the exception for interns and perhaps temporary maintenance workers, can have equally absurd results. So Oregon criminal defense lawyers would like to expand it beyond Department of Human Services, but not have it as broad as it is now. It's too broad now.
Counsel Larry.
Senator Ringo, I just wanted to add in response to your question, my read of the case that is was cited by Deputy Attorney General Fussner and is cited in the staff measure summary, I think that exact issue came up before the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals actually used the hypothetical of the Dungeness Crab Commission, if a report was made of the Dungeness Crab Commission. But the way they resolved it, and what I believe the state of the current law is right now, is that term that it currently reads as other governmental agency is interpreted by the Court of Appeals to mean a governmental agency or actor that has a duty to report under the child abuse reporting statute. So that's how the Court of Appeals resolved this potential ridiculous outcome where a claim of abuse could be made to the Dungeness Crab Commission, and they resolved that under current law that would not count as something triggering the statute of limitations. But in that case where it was a public school teacher who did have a duty to report, they resolved that that did trigger the statute. So I believe that is the current state of the law as interpreted by the case in the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
Maybe we could ask Mr. Fussner to come back up again because this raised a question of you that I'll wait till you get back up. The statute of limitations for mandatory reporters is, I believe, 3 years. Is that correct? Because there are penalties for failing to report.
Chair Burnett, the reporting of child abuse requirement for mandatory reporters is at ORS 419B.010, and it simply says any public or private official who learns of child abuse must report it to law enforcement or Department of Human Services. And it says that a person who violates that requirement commits a Class A violation, which is punishable only by a fine, not by any jail time. And prosecution of a person for being a mandatory reporter and failing to report a known incident of sexual abuse, the statute of limitations for filing that charge is 18 months after commission of the offense. And then you have at 419B.005 the list that I referred to of people who are mandatory reporters, and it does include quite a number of people, including temporary employees of a school district.
And legislators.
And legislators.
Because it seems to me one possible way out of this, and I don't know if this would resolve your concerns, is to, instead of keying it into the Department of Human Services, to key it into mandatory reporters who comply with the requirements of the law. In other words, they have to report it to to a governmental agency, an appropriate governmental agency who has mandatory reporting responsibilities, and that person complied with the mandatory reporting law, which is basically you get to the same place, but it's a little bit different route. Because I think that the issue here was, you know, why should the victim have to suffer when the mandatory reporter is the one who didn't do their job?
Madam Chair, I think that's a good suggestion, and right off the top of my head, that sounds like something that would work equally well, because the real purpose of this, again, is not to extend the statute of limitations so that we're trying cases that occurred way, way, way in the past. It really is to take care of the problem that arose in the Walker case and has arisen in other cases where a mandatory reporter doesn't report it, doesn't pass it on, and therefore no action is taken on it, and yet the statute of limitations is ticking away and the prosecution ends up being barred. So provided that we could have a provision in here that would say if the report is made to a mandatory reporter who promptly reports to DHS or law enforcement as required, I think that would be equally good.
Because there is no, from what you said, there's no deadline for the mandatory reporter to report. If they go 18 months, they're out of compliance, so at most that might cost you 18 months out of the...
I don't believe that there is a specific provision that says how soon a mandatory reporter has to make the report. It simply says if they have cause to believe that a child has suffered abuse, they shall immediately report. But there's, beyond saying immediately, there's no time limit on it. It might not be a bad idea to put one in if the changes that you suggested are made to this bill, and to say it provided that the mandatory reporter reports to law enforcement or DHS within, you know, 10 days or something like that.
Correct. Do you have any observations on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at first blush, I can tell you that would make the bill much less objectionable. Upon further thought, it might even make it fully acceptable. So I appreciate the chair for thinking creatively, and my organization will certainly work with all parties to advance the chair's goals, and I think we can get there on this one.
That's terrific. Thank you. You'll work together on this and maybe bring an amendment?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 203 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 208. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 208 would permit the Attorney General to enforce what is known as the Federal Do Not Call Registry. The bill also identifies and creates several legislative findings and identifies a purpose of the telephone solicitation statute. The statute declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Okay, why don't we start with Cheryl Pellegrini from the Department of Justice. Cheryl, welcome back to the committee. It's been a while since we've entertained ourselves on this issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I currently serve as the Attorney in Charge for the Department's Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section. Senate Bill 208, there is written testimony. I'll maybe read that just for your time that provides background on the evolution of what used to be the black dot law in Oregon to the no-call and then the advent of the federal registry. I would like to focus my comments to you at this point on where we are now. Briefly, in 1999, Oregon created a state no-call law. We were among the first seven states in the nation to do so. Under this law, telemarketers could not call Oregonians who paid to be on a state list. Oregonians were willing to pay to place 182,000 numbers on this list in order to avoid receiving unwanted telemarketing calls. Under the state program, consumers paid $6.50 per number to sign up initially, and then $3 per number per year to renew. Telemarketers initially paid $120 to receive copies of the list on an annual basis. Later, they were required to pay $250 to receive the list on a quarterly basis. This concept gained such popularity that in October of 2003, the federal government, through the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission, launched a federal Do Not Call registry. And that is in effect today, and it is free to consumers. You can call or go online to place a phone number on the list. Between June 27, 2003, the date consumers first could register their number on the federal registry, and June 18th, these are the latest statistics we can get from the feds, 660,276 Oregonians have registered phone numbers on the federal no-call list. This is about 3.5 times as many numbers as was on the state list. One of the governing laws for the National Registry requires that any state that wishes to maintain a state-enforced no-call program must incorporate into the state's list all of that state's phone numbers that are listed in the federal registry. So in other words, in order for a state to be able to enforce state law and have a state-run program, the list that the state is using for enforcement purposes has to contain all of the phone numbers that are currently on the federal registry. Current law does not allow the Attorney General to incorporate the phone numbers of Oregonians on the federal no-call list into a state list. We can't get there. Because of this, the state program that we had been running since 2000, it was preempted as of October 1st, 2003. We currently have no state no-call enforcement program. Now, states may bring an action in federal court under the federal laws on behalf of their residents under provisions of a telemarketing sales rule, or if they comply with the requirement that I've just explained, they can bring an action in their state court and enforce their state laws to address violations of no-call. I'll tell you that only a few states at this point maintain separate lists, and most of those separate lists are mirrors of the federal registry. Most states have designated the federal registry to serve as the state list.
Yeah, excuse me for interrupting. When they designate the federal registry as a state list, the people on that list do not have to pay. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. And that would be correct here in Oregon as well.
That is correct.
Okay.
Now, while as I've said, state attorney generals may bring an action in federal court, due to economic constraints, the Department of Justice typically only brings actions on behalf of Oregon consumers under state consumer protection laws. And that is because if the Attorney General were to bring an action under the federal telemarketing sales rule to enforce federal law for a violation of no-call, there is no provision in federal law that allows the Attorney General to recoup the costs of its investigation. So we would undertake an enforcement action at our own expense. Any civil penalties we collect would be paid to the federal government. This is an important point because in 2003, the legislature made the policy decision that the Department of Justice's Consumer Protection Program should operate without the contribution of any public funding. So from the beginning of last biennium forward, The Attorney General's program has not received any public funds. We receive no general funds. We operate solely based on the amount of money that is collected as a result of successful enforcement actions that we are able to bring. By allowing the Attorney General to designate the Federal Registry to serve as the no-call list, and this is what we would propose to do under Senate Bill 208, it would allow us to enforce state no-call law in state court for the benefit of Oregon consumers. Currently, neither of the federal agencies, the Federal Communications Commission or the Federal Trade Commission, has brought any action under federal law against any of the companies that comprise the top 10 list of companies the Oregonians have complained about. They have brought actions, but not against any of the companies that Oregonians have complained about the most. What Senate Bill 208 will enable us to do is to take action against those companies.
And could you tell us again what the fines are generally when someone is out of compliance with no-call, when somebody violates the no-call list?
Madam Chair, under state law or federal law?
If this were under state law.
Under state law? Under state law, remedies are found in the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and that provides for remedies of up to $25,000 per violation. But based on our history, remember we enforced this law for 4 years prior to its demise. What we had done was we had guidelines, internal guidelines that we used. If a company violated the law for the very first time, we did not seek $25,000 penalties. After establishing that there was in fact a violation, we essentially had a tiered system that we would use. And if a company continued to violate the law and it was brought to our attention, then we would seek further penalties. But it's up to $25,000. That's not just for no-call. That is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in general.
And how about the federal fines? How do those compare?
Under the telemarketing sales rule, each violation is punishable, or there's a civil penalty of up to $11,000 per violation.
All right, proceed. Are you done?
I'd like to do is just briefly give you a section-by-section analysis of the bill,
okay,
just to make clear what we're doing. In Section 1, that's a definition section, the word residential has been removed from the definition of party and telephone solicitation. The reason that we did this is to make clear that cell phones could register, or a person could register a cell phone number, a private cell phone number on the list, as well as a landline number. This would make the Oregon no-call law consistent with the federal no-call law. The original definitions of party and telephone solicitation were drafted back in 1989. That's before cell phones were in common use. And it was then drafted to distinguish between personal phones and business phones. By removing the word residential from these definitions, we're just broadening it to include cell phones.
And would it include fax lines as well?
No. Business-to-business calls continue to be excluded from the definition of telephone solicitation under Section 1, Subsection 3C.
And then how do the federal requirements deal with business-to-business calls?
They also do not apply. The federal provisions do not apply to business-to-business calls. So in that way, Oregon law would be consistent with federal law. And actually, Oregon law has always exempted business-to-business calls.
I know. That's been a source of great annoyance to some people.
Okay,
go ahead and continue.
The word property was replaced with the word real estate. That was a legislative council amendment to conform to the real estate goods or services language that's used throughout the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Section 2 just adds Senate Bill 2008 to existing Oregon law on unlawful telephone solicitation. Section 3 committee counsel mentioned is the legislative findings section. And what this section does is that there was an issue that came up in the 2003 session. There was an issue raised about whether or not the Oregon no-call, as it was drafted, might violate Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, the free speech provisions. And the concern was that whether or not it regulated speech, the content of speech, or whether it regulated conduct. It's always been the position of the Attorney General's office that this law has been designed to and does relate activity that's been found to be harmful to consumers, that's cold calling consumers to telemarket goods. The legislative findings would just make clear that the law targets conduct and not speech. Section 4 is just updating the definitions in the same way as Section 1. Section 5 is the actual prohibition. It makes it unlawful for any person to make a telephone solicitation to a party listed on either a list that is maintained by a private list administrator under contract with the Attorney General or as designated on a federal registry. Section 6 is really the heart of the bill. This gives the Attorney General the choice. He may do one of two things. He may designate the federal registry to serve as the state list, or he may contract with a private list administrator to maintain a state-run list. We can do one or the other. But remember, in order to have a state program, we must be able to incorporate the Oregon portion of the federal registry and designate it as the Oregon list. The only reason that we are seeking to maintain the ability to contract with a private list administrator is in the event that the federal registry at some point in the future is discontinued, if the federal government chooses at some point to defund it and moves that responsibility back onto the states. We would like to retain the ability to provide a seamless transition back to state maintenance without having to cause consumers and telemarketers to have to re-register and repurchase lists. That is the only reason that we want that is drafted in the disjunctive. It is our intent at this point to designate the federal registry to serve as Oregon's state list and to not have any state list administrator. It would be administered by the feds. We would just resume enforcement of the list under Oregon state law. Section 7 are the regulations pertaining to a contracted list administrator. Section 8 just designate the statutes or the series within the statutes of ORS that are amended by the bill. Section 9 is an emergency clause which declares that the act would be effective on passage. And again, that's because we would like to resume enforcement of this as soon as possible. I would be happy to answer any questions, and we would urge your support of this bill and to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
So it's your assumption and intent that the enforcement would increase if this bill became law and the Attorney General was able to have a self-funding mechanism to enforce?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, that committee. That is correct. The Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission, what they have done is that they're looking at the Federal Registry and they're looking at the companies that are garnering the highest number of complaints nationwide, and that's where they're focusing their resources. They're counting on the states to be able to come in and further protect their own citizens by bringing additional actions, either under federal or state law. Not all consumer protection programs function and are funded as Oregon's is. There are some consumer protection programs that are fully funded by general funds, and so they are in a much better position, for example, to bring actions in federal court, more so than we are.
And what is the federal requirement if the federal government has a different list of calls that are prohibited than the state? Is the state required, if they take over the program? I know they have to take over the list, but do they have to take over the same criteria as the feds?
Madam Chair, the exemptions maybe is
exemptions.
What? Yes, the exemptions to the federal list and the exemptions under Oregon law are substantially similar.
They are, but do they have to be?
Do they have to be the same?
Yes, do they have to be?
There is no requirement at the federal government at this point is not requiring states to have the same exemptions. What they're doing is they're strongly encouraging states to harmonize state exemptions with the federal exemption. For all intents and purposes, our exemptions are the same as the federal exemptions. And actually, under federal law, I think that the existing business relationship places a time limit of you have to have a contact within 18 months to claim that exemption. And under Oregon law, it's actually a little bit broader than the federal law.
How much broader?
There's no time limit.
Oh, I see.
It's a reasonable standard. Now, the Federal Trade Commission has requested of us, when we were in discussions with them in 2003, they had made the request of us and asked whether or not we would consider interpreting reasonable as within 18 months. So that's how we would attempt to harmonize
is that in
requirements.
I didn't see that in the bill. Is that in the bill, the 18 months?
It's in federal law.
It's in federal law, but you didn't make that change in this bill.
No, we did not.
But that wouldn't be any problem to make that change.
No, it wouldn't. That's correct.
Put that on your list.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Are you done with your presentation?
I am, Madam Chair, unless there are any
questions
other
from
questions.
The Senator Whitsitt.
Madam Chair, how would the civil fine generated by this law be allocated?
How would they be allocated? Under the State Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the short answer is if to the extent that we sued in court and the court awarded civil penalties, those civil penalties would go to the general fund. In addition, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act allows the Attorney General to seek reimbursement for the cost of its attorney fees and the cost of investigation. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Yes, I think so. There are no fines involved in it. Then it would be a civil action and a court award then.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, a civil penalty is, I mean, it's a monetary fine that the offending company would be required to pay if it was awarded by a court and it was designated as a civil penalty. It would be paid to the state general fund.
Okay.
It's not a criminal action. I think that's what you're
saying. Yes, I understand that. But
is there?
So just to clarify in my mind, other than the repayment of the actual costs of the Attorney General's office, there would be no profit motive for the department to pursue these issues. Other than being just repaid for your costs, there is no additional monies being. There would be no additional monies designated to the Department of Justice.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, before we sue, unless there are certain circumstances that exist, we are required by law to offer to a business the opportunity to enter into what's called an assurance of voluntary compliance. It's like a consent decree. It's filed with the court. It has the force of law. Under the provisions of that, monies may be paid to the Department of Justice in lieu of paying a civil penalty. Now, I will tell you that many businesses would much rather, and actually they will refuse, or they are very hesitant to pay anything that's designated as a civil penalty, because that term carries with it the connotation of liability. If they're allowed to enter into an assurance of voluntary compliance, there is no finding of liability or that they have broken the law, and that assurance in the court order cannot be used as an admission or of a violation for any other purpose. As part of it's a negotiated agreement, the company can agree to pay, and the Department of Justice can agree to accept payment beyond its costs in the nature of a deterrent payment to deter future conduct. We found that in these cases, if businesses are required to only pay the cost of investigation, it becomes the cost of doing business. We do our job very well, and we do it very economically. Without any financial deterrent, the value of an assurance to the department becomes meaningless. In addition, we can require businesses to pay restitution to consumers. That is an amount that they would pay over and above anything that the department receives, although it may be paid to the department and then dispersed for the benefit of consumers. And that's when we make them do that to make sure that they actually pay the money. So, yes, we do in some instances collect money beyond that which it actually costs us to operate. That engenders a broader discussion of what we do with that money. Since we receive no public funding, the section is required by law to perform more than a law enforcement function. We also provide assistance to individual consumers. All of the educational work that we do and all of the outreach work that we do is at our own expense. We receive no public funding for the brochures. We receive no public funding for all the public speaking engagements. We receive no public funding for all the training that we put on for businesses and consumers. So the money that we collect from case settlements goes to fund that whole other portion of the work that the department is required by statute to do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Sounds like we violate the Latin at me.
Well, if they didn't violate the law, they wouldn't have the problem, Senator Beyer. Thank you very much. If there are no other questions, we will move to our next witness, Paul Cosgrove from United Financial. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Financial Services Association, which is a member of the United Financial Lobby, which is a group of us that represent a variety of financial institutions, including banks, mortgage brokers, credit unions, and members of OFSA who are consumer finance licensees licensed by the state. I'm passing out to you a brief summary prepared by our national affiliate, the American Financial Services Association, about the concerns we have about dual lists and why we support the national list. I'd like to step back and say that I represent people and the members, and the United Financial Lobby represents other members who have always complied with Oregon's Black Dot program, complied with Oregon's no-call list when it switched from Black Dot, and currently comply with the national list. Now, is our compliance 100% perfect? I'm sure that's not true, but we make diligent efforts to do so, and I think generally we're considered to be good compliers. So we're not opposed to no-call lists by any means, but we are greatly concerned that the way Senate Bill 208 is drafted, it allows the Attorney General, as Ms. Pellegrini testified, to make choices about whether to have a state-run program or a national program. And she admitted that there are a number of differences, as the chair pointed out, some pro-consumer, some anti-consumer, between the two statutes. And this bill doesn't harmonize any of those. That is of great concern to us. Now that we have a federal list and are complying with that federal list, we're very concerned that we not have what we were starting to have a number of years ago, which is multiple different states, similar but not quite the same, different ways to comply, similar but not quite the same, different penalties enforcement, different exemptions, similar but not quite the same. And I think what Ms. Pellegrini pointed out to you in her testimony is that we still have that problem in Oregon if this bill is passed. The second point I'd like to make is that the comments.
Wait, before you move on, can you give some specific examples of requirements that Oregon would have? And there's a difference between the lists and the requirements. You're not complaining about the. Are you complaining about the option of having an alternative list if the federal one goes out of business?
Madam Chair, that is of concern to us because it doesn't require the Attorney General under this bill to designate the federal list. It says the Attorney General may. You've heard what the Attorney General's opinion is of their current intention, but that current intention could change sometime in the future, and we might end up with two lists. Under the law, it would be perfectly lawful for a future Attorney General to do that designation.
Okay, well, that's one issue. The other issue is the requirements themselves. Yeah. Where specifically do you see differences?
One of them is one that Ms. Pellegrini mentioned, and you talked about the 18-month prior business relationship. The prior business relationship exemption in Oregon is actually, in my view, much narrower, and the reason I say that, it was a session or two ago that I negotiated that with Ms. Pellegrini, and it affected only financial institutions who have mergers and the issues of what happens when a financial institution merges and it keeps the name of one of the subsidiaries. Is it a prior business relationship even though it's a new entity? Attorney General's opinion in Oregon is that was not true. In the federal law is much clearer and cleaner. It does have an 18-month limit, but it's much clearer and cleaner, and it's that kind of merger issue is not limited to financial institutions. We made a change in Oregon limited to financial institutions because it was our clients who brought the issue forward. But frankly, other businesses would have the same kind of problem. Other businesses also merge. So that's an example of a difference where part of it is perhaps Oregon is more pro-consumer, and part of it, the difference is the feds are more pro-consumer. But those kinds of small but important differences exist throughout the statute. Mm-hmm. The definitions are similar but not identical. It seems to me if we were really looking at making sure that those differences did not exist, we would adopt the federal language in the federal act, and we would adopt the federal rules as they've been promulgated over a several-year period with lots of opportunity to comment and with lots of opportunity to fine-tune that language. That's not what the current Oregon statute has. I'm sure there are other examples. That's the one that comes immediately to mind of the differences. Okay. And as I say, those differences are not ultimately a great deal different from a consumer's perspective, perhaps, or even from a business's, but it gives us the problem of unintended violations if we're complying with one and happen not to quite comply with another. So that is of concern. The second thing I would just mention about the findings, I think Ms. Pellegrini is aware that with respect to federal free speech issues, and I recognize there's a difference between federal and state free speech issues under our constitutions, one party made a complaint that the federal law violated the federal constitution's free speech, and a case came down just very, very recently saying that's not true. I expect an Oregon court would find exactly the same thing under our Article 1, Section 8. And frankly, the kind of significantly pejorative statements and findings that are being asked of the legislature in this bill sound more to me like an advocacy piece than a series of findings. And there hasn't been any evidence that I'm aware of, and frankly, I think the Attorney General admits it's been out of the enforcement business for a couple of years. There hasn't been any basis provided to you here, and I don't think they have any evidence to support all of the allegations of fraud. And some of those, I think, unintendedly, but do affect our clients. And if that's not necessary, we think that's objectionable. And then finally, assuming we harmonized and assuming the issue of the findings were sort of resolved, we still have the problem with respect to dual enforcement. Now, it may be true, based on the Attorney General's comments and the information they've received from FTC, that the top 10 complained about parties in Oregon have not been on the FTC's list so far. But the FTC is, in fact, enforcing. And we would have the potential problem of state enforcement combined with federal enforcement under this statute. I would and dual penalties. I'd point out, too, that it's not exactly accurate to state that the federal penalties don't go to the benefit of the state. They may not go into the Attorney General's budget, but I'd like to read to you very briefly where the federal penalties go under federal law. The Attorney General, this is in a section of the federal law specifically authorizing state attorney generals to enforce the federal law. The Attorney General may bring a case to obtain damages, restitution, and other compensation on behalf of residents of such state, or to obtain such further and other relief as the court may deem appropriate. The citizens of Oregon can be benefited by Attorney General's enforcement of the federal law even without Senate Bill 208. So it's not exactly correct to say that it all goes to the feds. It doesn't. It can go and should go to those people harmed, the individual citizens.
But has there ever been a case where they've collected something and distributed to the citizens since the feds took over that you know of?
Madam Chair, since Oregon hasn't ever attempted to enforce it, it certainly hasn't occurred here. I do not know whether other states who have enforced the federal law have sought that. I expect I can find that out, but I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine a good aggressive attorney general would in fact seek to do that for obvious reasons. So in sum, we have concerns about Section 20, Senate Bill 208. We have concerns about duplication and inconsistency and harmonization. I'd be happy to answer any questions of members of the committee.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Sosko. I have a question on your third point about the dual enforcement. Is it your position that you just don't want the State Attorney General's office to have any enforcement capability?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, technically, of course, right now the state has enforcement authority. It just has enforcement authority of the federal statute, not a state statute. It's saying, the Attorney General's office is saying, based on, I believe it was a budget note. I wasn't involved in the Department of Justice budget enough to know, but my understanding is that they're saying as a practical matter they can't enforce unless they get the money. So my concern about dual enforcement is enforcement by two agencies for the same problem, i.e. FTC through its Attorney General and the state of Oregon. And I don't think there's anything in this bill that prevents that from happening.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Well, I'm just trying to follow up. I mean, the information passed out by the Attorney General's office says that Oregon's no-call list is currently unenforceable. And I think that refers to by the state attorney general's office. And I'm not, it sounds like you disagree with that statement.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I agree with it. Oregon's no-call list is unenforceable, but the state has the authority to enforce the federal no-call list,
okay,
which is much bigger and much broader than Oregon's old list. You're correct, though. The Oregon's list is no longer enforceable.
But you don't have a problem with the concept of the state attorney general's office enforcing the federal no-call list with respect to Oregon?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions, Senator Byers? Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Okay. This bill, I think, needs a little work, and I think there is a legitimate point on the findings section. I think that can be recast in a different way. Would you like to come back, Senator? I mean, Liz Pellegrini.
Just to get the answer to that question. Thank you again for the record, Cheryl Pellegrini, Department of Justice. The findings were, they're contained in the FTC's findings.
I see. So these are exactly the same findings. Well, that makes it a little more tricky. There's no question about that.
And the FTC's findings are based on the experience of the states.
Okay. And my other comment on this is that I think the comment about harmonization is a good one, but I'd want it to be done in a way that preserves, if Oregon wants to be more co-consumer than the feds, then that's fine, but it should be done in a way that's transparent and easily understandable.
And Madam Chair, that we don't have a problem with that. That would be fine with the department. We'd certainly welcome the opportunity to work with Mr. Cosgrove on, in particular, that business
business relationship exemption language.
And the other comment that I had is, that's about it that comes to mind now. And I do think we have a stronger free speech provision than the federal government does in Oregon. So I'm not sure that I'm assured that the Oregon Supreme Court would make the same finding as the federal Supreme Court did or the federal appellate courts.
I'm sure that is correct.
But I still would like to figure out if there's another way we could be Article 1, Section 8 compliant with maybe a little different use of language. I think that harmonizes with the federal findings, but maybe phrases things a little differently.
Be happy to.
Thank you. Okay, well, I will work with you, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Are there some specific examples where you think the Oregon no-call list provides consumers greater protection in any significant way? In other words, if you harmonize, are we going to lose something in terms of protecting Oregon consumers?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, the only one that I can immediately think of is the charitable exemption. And I can tell you what the Oregon one is, and I can paraphrase the federal exemption. The Oregon charitable exemption says that unless you are calling a member of your organization or someone who has donated to your organization in the past or who has expressed an interest in donating to your organization, you may not call them if the number is on the list. So that's the carve-out. Charities, essentially, like everybody else, are prohibited from cold calling for donations. I think that the federal list is a little bit broader, and it does permit, under certain circumstances, charities to what I would consider to be cold call, meaning calling someone with whom they've had no contact previously and where the person has not indicated any interest in having contact with the caller.
And do you happen to know if they define, if Oregon would define interest, say if one environmental group gives another environmental group their list, do you know if that would comply as an interest under Oregon law? One like group or Mercy Corps gives their list to Northwest Medical Teams and they call from that list. Mm. Do you know if that meets the requirement of interest?
Good question, Madam Chair. I would say that under the charitable exemption, the organization that received the list, they could only call if the people on that list had given to that other organization or expressed an interest in giving to disaster relief organizations in general, you know, in the past. Then perhaps they may be able to call them. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. It's a little bit blurry. I mean, everybody's a tsunami organization these days, so it's a little
that's a very good question.
To answer Senator Ringo's question, it's definitely stronger protection for the consumer.
Yes.
Who may not want to get.
Yes, and then if I could just make one more point of clarification, as far as the ability of the Attorney General to recoup money under federal law, it's for damages and restitution. Now, as far as we know, the federal actions that have been taken have not sought damages or restitution on behalf of residents because, for one thing, it's very hard to place a monetary figure, a dollar amount, on a telephone call. You know, what we're talking about is people, telemarketers, who are calling people at their homes, and the residents are picking up the phone and receiving calls they don't want. In terms of translating that into restitution or damages, it really doesn't fit. That provision applies to all other provisions in the telemarketing sales rule, which covers conduct, the actual telemarketing fraud, where you're selling people false or phony goods.
I don't think we need to worry too much about that line of concern. Senator Byer, did you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. You know, the Section 3, I guess, and I had some problems with that also. And so now, in your opinion, was 646 a constitutional statute prior to the Federal Act under the Oregon Constitution?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, was the Oregon law constitutional prior to the Federal Registry?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, then, Madam Chair, I don't understand why, if it's constitutional before and you want to adopt basically the same act, which is bring a new list into it, why you need to have all these findings and facts to make it constitutional.
The Madam Chair, Senator Byer, under the only what 208 allows us to do is just say, instead of having a private listed, a private state list run by a private list administrator, we're going to use the federal list.
I understand that, but...
But all other provisions of Oregon law remain. There were concerns raised in the 2003 legislature by some members that Oregon law, as it was drafted, and as the may run afoul of the way that the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, was currently being interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court. That's the problem.
I understand that, but you maintain that it was constitutional because it hadn't been challenged, and now this act at the federal level has been challenged and it was upheld, so why do you have to put this language, which you say mirrors the federal language, into this act, which was already constitutional in your opinion? It seems like it's redundant, and it's objectionable to me personally to include this in the Oregon Act.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, it is what we would consider prophylactic on the part of the Department of Justice, clarifying that this act pertains to conduct, not speech. As opposed to doing nothing, waiting until it's challenged, and then having to bear the expense of litigating it through the courts. I mean, this is a much more it's a much more direct way of clarifying the intent of the law and of preserving that intent and for the court to consider should there be a challenge.
Yeah, I agree with Senator Byer about the tone of the language, certainly, and I think probably if they can come up with some way of clarifying that if this is related to conduct rather than to content of speech, then that will be fine, because there were concerns raised about Article 1, Section 8, and just because there hasn't been a lawsuit so far doesn't mean there won't be one, and there's less motivation for it to have a lawsuit when there's no enforcement going on. So,
well, or just leave it out altogether and not try to maintain dual lists and just...
Yeah, this really has nothing. That's what's so confusing. This has nothing to do with the list. The list issue is separate.
I would disagree, because if Oregon doesn't have this statute and try to maintain a potential dual list, and you don't need any of this, use the federal list.
But this statute allows, or the purpose of this statute, and correct me if I'm wrong, is to allow Oregon to enforce violations of the federal list.
And it's disputed whether or not that's necessary.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it is. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you very much. So we will work a little bit on some of these issues and bring this back to our committee.
Thank you.
We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 208. And now the long-awaited, breathless presentation, the informational meeting on the Blakely case. Don't everyone leave at once. This presentation has gotten fabulous reviews elsewhere in the building.
We were in a telephone community for a while.
Okay, Roger, you're on. I had to get dispensation from Judy to get this in today, but I did it for you, Roger. Thank you, Joe. Welcome to the committee on the other side of the...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Mr. Taylor asked me to give a brief presentation to you about the current status of some of the sentencing cases that have come out of the United States Supreme Court and the Oregon Supreme Court, and to also kind of give you a just fundamental picture of what
the sentencing guidelines are, what a departure sentence is, and then to give you kind of an idea of what the group of people known as the Blakely Work Group are sorting out and what options you and the rest of the Legislative Assembly may have this session in trying to work out what to do in response to some of the United States Supreme Court decisions and the Oregon Supreme Court decisions. I want to start just with a basic fundamental overview of what sentencing felony sentencing is in Oregon. There are two things that are discussed when we talk about sentencing. One is called the statutory maximum. It's sometimes also called the statutory indeterminate maximum. I made you a cheat sheet, by the way, that gives you a little summary of each of these cases. And this term that I'm using right now is down at the very end on page 2. And the citation for the statutory indeterminate maximums is on that page.
Do we have that cheat sheet?
I don't think we do. We have that?
I think mine was in with the agenda. It was underneath the agenda.
They're trying to hide things from the committee.
Well, you guys just saved them for yourself and then turn with us.
We don't want you to know too much about this, Senator Byer.
Well, you have either, do you?
I'm on the work group, so Wagner. Oh, no, I don't have the information.
Maybe I got the only copy. I will provide you with copies.
You could have Dale. Dale, are you able to do that? Or
yeah, I can actually.
Send out for help? Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
So I'll give it a stab here without this. There's statutory indeterminate sentences. Those are set by statute. It's at 161605. That's set at the level of the offense. So a Class A felony has a statutory indeterminate sentence of 20 years. A Class B felony has a statutory indeterminate sentence of up to 10 years. And a Class C has a statutory indeterminate sentence of up to 5 years. So the meaning of those statutes is that the court would have discretion to impose a sentence for a Class C felony, for example, of any time from 0 to 5 years. There's another layer, though, besides the statutory indeterminate sentences, and those are the sentencing guidelines. The sentencing guidelines are promulgated by regulation. They're produced by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. And they are presented, those regulations are presented to the Legislative Assembly every biennium for approval. They must be approved by the Legislative Assembly before they have the force of law. So the sentencing guidelines, those regulations, are summarized in this document that I'm showing to you right now. And when you get a copy of it, you will see it. We call it the grid. And it is a kind of operates in a way like a bingo card. Across the top of the grid is a chart of the offender's criminal history. Starts down here at the low end with somebody with no criminal history as an I, and tops out here at the high end of the grid with somebody who has a criminal history of 3 or more person felonies, either adult or juvenile felonies. The other side of the grid is the crime seriousness level. And again, this is something that's set by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and then approved by the legislature through these OARs, Oregon Administrative Rules. The high end of the crime seriousness level is 11. The low end of the crime seriousness level is 1. For every single, with a few exceptions, with almost every single felony provided for in the Oregon revised statutes, there is a designation of the crime seriousness level in these OARs, and it's reflected in this grid. The writing around the outside of the grid that I'm pointing to now is kind of a cheat sheet for practitioners, so that when we look at a charging instrument or if we're a prosecutor and we're thinking about charging someone with something, we can look and we can see that, for example, the offense of criminal mistreatment is a level 7 in the crime seriousness part of the grid, which is about a little more than halfway up. Now, meanwhile, note that the indeterminate statutory maximum for criminal mistreatment, using that example, is it's a Class C felon by statute, so it's a five-year maximum. This grid basically creates a different maximum sentence. This grid, if you were charged with criminal mistreatment or your client or your defendant were charged with criminal mistreatment, you would look it up, you would see it to level 7, you would find out what the individual's criminal history was. If they had no criminal history, you would line up the low end of the grid, which is an I, no criminal history, with the crime seriousness level 7, and you would come up with a number. In this case, you would come up with what's called the presumptive sentence. And the presumptive sentence for the hypothetical that I just gave you is a term of 3 years of probation and 90 days in jail or 180 days in a work release type institution. Now, use the same offense, criminal mistreatment, a level 7 offense, Class C felony, for a person who has 3 or more person felonies on their record. I'm jumping to the high end of the criminal history part of the grid. So this same offense committed by somebody with 3 or more person felonies goes to a different grid block, which is 31 to 36 months of prison. What I'm explaining to you now are the presumptive sentences in these two kind of hypotheticals where the person convicted has no criminal history, the person convicted has a serious criminal history, same offense, all things being equal. The presumptive sentence is going to be what I just told you, 31 to 36 months if it's somebody with 3 or more person felonies, or 3 years of probation and 90 days jail for somebody with no criminal history whatsoever. Now I'm going to tie this to why these Supreme Court cases of the last few months are important. And the memo that I think you've been provided with now has brief summaries of each of these important cases. The biggest one and the one that you're going to hear about over and over again is Blakely versus Washington. And here was the issue. It wasn't an Oregon case, but it was a state of Washington case. And exactly like Oregon's sentencing system, Washington had statutory indeterminate sentences on the books, and they had a sentencing guideline set up. And they gave different numbers for what the maximum possible sentence that the judge could give is. And the issue in Blakely was that under the grid, Mr. Blakely, who I think was charged with kidnapping or something like that, his presumptive sentence was something like 30 months. The exact number is in the memo. I'm not looking at it right now. But there was a provision in the Washington sentencing guidelines, as there is in the Oregon sentencing guidelines, for the judge to say, you know what, this is a special case, and there are really compelling reasons that I, as the trial judge, find to go above the 30-month presumptive sentence that I would give you under the grid. And in Blakely's case, it was something like deliberate cruelty to the victim, who was his wife, who he duct taped and threw in the back of a pickup truck and held a gun to her head or something like this while his son watched. It was a really emotional and compelling case. So the judge made those factual findings on his own that those facts constituted deliberate cruelty and departed from the presumptive sentence that Blakely would have gotten normally, 30-month that the grid said, and gave him 90. Now, that 90-month sentence was still less than the statutory indeterminate sentence, the maximum sentence on the books, for this Class C felony example that I'm giving you, the 5-year maximum. It was still under that. But Blakely argued that the real maximum sentence for purposes of his due process right should be this grid block. In the hypothetical that I'm giving you, it should be 30 months. And in an opinion by Justice Scalia in the U.S. Supreme Court, the majority agreed and said that the right to due process and the right to a jury trial requires that any fact that would aggravate the sentence beyond which was
set by law, and they considered the maximum sentence to be the sentencing guideline sentence, had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. So the judge just couldn't make those findings on his own and aggravate the sentence on his own. Even though those facts were probably very much there and very much provable, because they weren't proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, the maximum that Blakely could get was, I want to make sure I'm saying it right here, it was 49 to 53 months in the Blakely case itself. Now, when that case came down, there was much speculation about whether or not the reasoning of that case, which again, it's a competition between what's really the maximum sentence when the legislature or Congress sets an indeterminate maximum, 5, 10, 20 years, but also has a practical maximum, like the sentencing guidelines. What is really the maximum sentence? And Blakely said, as far as Washington's scheme is concerned, it's the grid. The grid is the maximum sentence. And to go beyond the maximum sentence in the grid, any fact, except for a prior conviction, or except for something that the defendant actually admits through a guilty plea, for example, has got to be pled to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Thus, the issue becomes, does the Blakely rule apply to the federal sentencing guidelines? The U.S. Supreme Court last week answered yes in a case called Booker and Fanfan. That's summarized in my notes to you. The next issue, does the Blakely decision apply to the Oregon sentencing guidelines? The Oregon Supreme Court has answered that question, yes. That case is State versus Dilts, which was decided in September of 2004. That's also summarized for you in my memo. The posture that these cases bring us to then is how is the court able to find circumstances in which a departure sentence, that is a sentence where it's deemed that there are sufficient aggravating factors to give someone a sentence beyond their presumptive grid, how does that happen? Because right now, under Oregon law, there is no provision by which a jury can make those findings unless it's part of the elements of the crime. And
so before you go too much further, are you going to... it seems to me that you should talk about how ballot measure 11 fits in with these, because were you going to get to that? I didn't need that.
You know, I can address that. I hadn't planned to, but I can address that.
Yeah, because the sentencing guide, Measure 11, has a different sentencing structure, and the sentencing guidelines apply basically, by and large, to non-Measure 11
sentences. Absolutely.
Senator
McGill? Well, could I just ask a couple questions about midstream here?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. And I may be jumping ahead here. Does the Blakely case mean that we're going to have to let a bunch of people out early? Are we going to be revisiting sentences?
I think what your question goes to is whether or not the Blakely decision has retroactive effect. And I frankly do not know the answer. I think that there are cases...
Are there some people that think it does mean that?
I think that there are many cases right now that are pending appeal in which there were departure sentences imposed. So the person had a grid block of 31, but the court on its own found aggravating factors to warrant a higher sentence. And those individuals are appealing their convictions through, I think, three ways. One is a motion for resentencing. One is a direct appeal arguing a legal error on the part of the court. And the third could be through what's called a post-conviction relief petition, arguing that their counsel gave them ineffective assistance because their counsel should have known that this case was about to be decided, or in some cases had been decided.
If I could just provide a little insight, I've been attending work group meetings. The feeling in the work group is that there are various levels of risk of having exact convictions that have already been made. overturned. The feeling is that there's a pretty high level of risk that cases that are in the system now, the event occurred before Blakely, the charges may be before Blakely, but they're still in the system, that there's a very high risk, in fact, that those would be affected by Blakely. But there is, it's not risk-free, but there's considerably less risk that cases that have already been adjudicated and are completely out of the system, there's a much better chance that those will not be retroactively determined. And but there are cases now working their way through the system. In fact, we may be hearing one in this committee at the Court of Appeals. There are cases working their way through the system that will answer that question, and we really won't know until they do.
I'm sure.
Senator Byer?
What happens in the cases where the judge may have departed downward?
Does not affect a downward departure at all. I think where that comes from is that the idea, the analysis behind the right to due process and the right to a jury trial, it's based on anything that aggravates the sentence, increases the sentence beyond that which is the maximum sentence. So if we're talking about a downward departure, which the sentencing guidelines do provide for, there are instances where the judge can go lower than what the presumptive gridlock is. That is not something that would need to be pled and proved to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, because it doesn't inure to the detriment of the defendant. It's inuring to the benefit of the defendant. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that answers the question, but could the state come back and argue that the judge's departure downward was detrimental to the state and then ask that sentence to be set aside? And
I think that Senator Byer, I think that issue, I believe, actually was raised, and I'm not sure where it was. I believe it was in a federal case, and I believe that was decided in that case that the argument could be made that it was not well taken. And I think the reason for that is, but I do not know for sure, but I think the reason for that is that it's not the defendant's burden to do anything when charged with a crime. It's the prosecution's burden to move forward and to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did what the state says it did, and to seek the punishment for it. So I think that if the argument were made, and again, I don't know if this argument has been made yet in state court or not, but I think if it were made, if it were my case, I think my response to that, if I were the defense attorney, would be, it's not inuring to the detriment of the defendant, so there's no right that is being violated. The state does not have a due process right to seek a higher conviction than the maximum. The state doesn't have a jury trial right, I think, to present those issues to the jury.
That's a good question.
I can try to find that case for you, too, as long as you don't absolutely hold me to it if I can't find it. I can test my legal research skills.
Are you back to Measure 11?
Yeah, and Measure 11, to my mind, the Blakely decision does not have an impact at all on Measure 11, or if it does, would do so in only very limited circumstances. Let me explain what it is first. This what I've just showed you, the sentencing guidelines, these are the presumptive sentences for felony offenses. And as Senator Byer pointed out, the court can find mitigating circumstances to go lower, or the court can find aggravating circumstances to go a little bit higher under this current framework, which under Blakely is arguably unconstitutional, is unconstitutional according to the Oregon Supreme Court. Separate from these presumptive sentences for these enumerated felonies, there is a list of about, I don't know how many there are. There are about 15 or 20, 16 I'm hearing from the gallery. Thank you. Enumerated felonies which have been designated by the legislature as ballot measure 11 crimes. It's commonly known as ballot measure 11 crimes. They're codified at 137.700. And for any conviction for those specific offenses, arson, murder, assault in the first degree, assault in the second degree, rape in the first degree, rape in the second degree, etc., that carries with it a mandatory minimum sentence. And that is the sentence. The court doesn't have any discretion but to impose that sentence. They are still, those felonies are still categorized under the sentencing guidelines, and in theory, I suppose the court could depart upward from a Measure 11 sentence. Under Blakely and under Diltz, the court couldn't do that, though, without a finding by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. The other area where it might come into, where Blakely may have some effect, and this is still pretty unclear, but it is the issue of consecutive sentences, where the court, for example, an individual may have been convicted of two counts of sexual abuse, where the relevant dates that are alleged to the conduct are on or between a series of a month. And if the proof that was offered for those offenses is, if it is unclear whether or not those were two separate incidences of sexual abuse or two incidences that happened over the course of the same transaction, the same act or transaction, then it could be an issue of whether or not the court can give two consecutive sentences for each conviction. And that would be a circumstance where the judge, under current law, would have to make certain factual findings in order to impose consecutive or stacked sentences. That may very well implicate Blakely, too, and what that may the remedy for that may be as simple as recrafting jury instructions very carefully to make sure, and from the end of the, from the perspective of the prosecutor, crafting your indictments very carefully to make sure that you are alleging separate acts or transactions, and then in the jury verdict to make sure that there is an opportunity for the jury to say whether or not they find that the two charges are separate acts or transactions. That could solve it.
Okay. And then the other area of concern that is working its way through the courts right now is the interpretation of juvenile prior offenses. In other words, if someone commits a crime under sentencing guidelines, a juvenile adjudication puts them higher in the grid, but those adjudications are done by a judge without a jury. So it's entirely possible that prior juvenile adjudications will not be able to be considered as a reason unless there's, in fact, there's no practical way to do a finding beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, because there is, in fact, no right to a jury in exactly. juvenile delinquency cases.
So when you come to prior convictions that were done by a jury or with access to a jury, like a plea bargain that was entered into, then you're absolutely safe on that. When it's other aggravating factors or possibly a juvenile adjudication, then you've got a problem.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry for keeping interrupting. I just can't control myself.
I'm not supposed to interrupt you. I've learned, actually, just from the last meeting of this Blakely work group, I don't remember the exact statistic, but I was not aware of this before, that the incidences of upward departure, this kind of speaks to Senator Ringo's question about is this going to open the floodgates a little bit? And the incidences of, I think the answer is no. The reason is the incidence of upward departures is actually relatively low. The chair can correct me if I'm wrong. I think the number was in the low teens percentage. And of that number of upward departures, I think I recall it being said that the overwhelming majority are actually stipulated upward departures. So that's a circumstance where the defendant is admitting to the aggravating factor. The reason for that goes to a question I believe that Senator Burdick asked yesterday regarding the Measure 11 related offenses on Ms. Porter's economic analysis. What happens often is, in order to avoid a mandatory minimum Measure 11 sentence, a plea bargain is entered into where the defendant will plead to an attempted Measure 11 sentence, thereby getting out of Measure 11. But that attempted Assault 1 might get them too low on the grid to be palatable for the state. So they have to, the defendant would have to agree to an upward departure to get to the number that is palatable to the state and still palatable to the defendant, avoiding a Measure 11 sentence, still not getting a probation sentence. But if it's admitted to by the defendant, then there's no problem. And my point is that based on the figures that I've heard in the Blakely work group from the State Court Administrator's Office and the Criminal Justice Commission, that's what most of the departures are right now. That's not to say that there should not be a mechanism by which a departure, an upward departure, can be reached, and it's obviously got to be, if it's done, it's got to be done in compliance with the Constitution and compliance with the Blakely case.
Thank you. Are there any last questions? We're out of time. Thank you very much. This is very good.
Thank you.
This committee is adjourned. And we have a fix for adjournment.